Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Who doesn't like recess? It's one of the things we probably miss most about school. A chance to get out for some fresh air, play hopscotch, hang on the monkey bars. So it should be in Washington, except when there is a recess appointment. Then the air turns foul, politicians wrestle on the playground, and the hopscotch will likely end up in a courtroom. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Thanks for joining us for the Marketplace podcast. It is Wednesday, the fourth day of January and the new year. Aren't we glad our recesses didn't look like this? Today, President Barack Obama threw down against his opponents in Congress, in the Senate to be specific, and appointed Richard Cordray to head up the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. The White House nominated the former Ohio Attorney General last year, but Democrats could not muster the 60 votes necessary to confirm him. And Republicans have used Senate rules to stay technically in session even while on vacation. So in Cleveland today, the president indicated he'd had enough.
Now's not the time to play politics while people's livelihoods are at stake. Now's the time to do everything we can to protect consumers, prevent financial crises like the one that we've been through from ever happening again. That starts with letting Richard do his job.
Many Republicans have opposed the CFPB from its inception as part of the Dodd-Frank financial reform law, and they are set to challenge his recess appointment, which they say did not happen during recess. So, what happens now? For some answers, we're joined by Rob Blackwell, Washington Bureau Chief for American Banker. Welcome.
Hi, happy to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
So I suppose the question here is, is this finally going to allow the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau to do what it is supposed to do?
You know, ostensibly would seem to, because, you know, you've put a director in place, but the legal authority here is really questionable. And so what's really going to end up happening is anything the CFPB does to regulate non-banks is going to wind up thrown into court.
And again, that is because this was a recess appointment, but not just a recess appointment, but an appointment during a time when some members of Congress say they weren't in recess.
Right. There are really two legal issues at play here. One is that it's a recess appointment when the Senate technically, officially, isn't in recess.
Right.
So there's a question of whether or not Obama really can make the recess appointment.
Right.
Legal issue number two is that the Dodd-Frank law says that a director has to be confirmed by the Senate to exercise its broader powers over non-banks, that's check cashers and payday lenders and those kind of people.
Mortgage brokers.
Right, exactly, mortgage brokers. It's fairly clear the statute, if you look at it, it says has to be confirmed by the Senate. And Richard Cordray, even if he's recess appointed, he's not confirmed by the Senate.
Hmm.
What you're going to hear is the Obama White House is going to say, well, look, there's no difference between a Senate confirmed and a recess appointment. But a lot of Republicans and a lot of privately Democrats think that's not true. And they worry that anything that Cordray does as CFPB director could be challenged in a court of law and could be overturned.
Well, okay then. So let's say that Richard Cordray tomorrow decides he's going to go after payday lenders. What happens?
I think very quickly you're going to see either the payday lenders or the U.S. Chamber of Commerce or some other industry group affected by it. They're going to file suit in a court of law that says President Obama wasn't allowed to recess appoint Cordray. And even if he was, Cordray isn't allowed to, you know, use the powers of the CFPB to go after non-banks.
So what's the way out of this? I mean, is there any way forward, given that the parties kind of aren't talking to each other?
I don't see a good way forward. I think for the foreseeable future, certainly to the end of the presidential election, you're going to see a CFPB that is going to try and be activist, is going to try and flex its muscles a little bit and go after these non-bank lenders. And lawsuits are going to result from that, and they're just going to fight it out in court. And that's going to take a while to resolve itself.
And in the meantime, it's consumers who are stuck in the middle.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, it sounds great. I think President Obama probably did something that politically helps him, but on policy will end up hurting the agency he's trying to promote. Because anything that agency does now will be under this legal cloud and this legal threat, and we're going to see that go on for some time to come.
Rob Blackwell is the Washington Bureau Chief for American Banker Magazine. Thanks so much for talking us through this.
Sure. Thank you very much for inviting me.
Do you Yahoo? Well, apparently lots of you do, because it remains the world's fourth most popular website. And that's the problem. It's stuck there. The company's been through a series of CEOs who've been under pressure to turn around the company's online advertising business. Today, yet another new leader, Scott Thompson, former president of eBay's online payment unit, PayPal. Our senior business correspondent Bob Moon looks at this latest transaction in Yahoo's mixed history.
It's been quite a while since investors have been singing its praises.
Yahoo!
That's because the company has struggled to compete with Google and Facebook, even though it's one of the Internet's most popular destinations. John Abel has been a longtime follower of the company at Wired Magazine.
They have 700 million users. They get mad traffic. Number four in the world and number four in the United States is pretty darn big.
But Yahoo isn't growing beyond its loyal following. Abel says the company lost its way when it shifted its focus from being an Internet gateway to actually creating content. And he thinks Thompson, as PayPal's former chief technology officer, can help Yahoo refocus.
He is a signal that the pretension of being a media company is over, and now we're going to try this again. We have all the data in the world and a lot of people like us. So how do we maximize that and stop trying to be something, you know, sexy?
At Evercore Partners, analyst Ken Senna agrees Yahoo can use a leader who's strong on the tech side. He says the company needs to expand its reach and pull in more advertisers through new technologies, from smartphones to tablet computers.
To get people to actually want to use Yahoo, you know, as frequently as they did before, but in kind of a new online environment.
The move could hold off Yahoo's possible sale, either in pieces or the whole company. Analyst Brett Harris watches Yahoo at Gabelli & Company.
You wouldn't hire a CEO and then sell the company.
That may depend, though, on how long the CEO lasts. Thompson will be Yahoo's fourth chief exec in less than 5 years. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Remember when Martha Stewart was everywhere? In retail stores, on TV? Okay, yes, in jail. Well, the good things appear to be ebbing. Last May, Martha Stewart Living indicated it might need to find a buyer after years of declining sales. In December, the company struck a deal to gain a retail foothold in JCPenney stores. But today, the Hallmark Channel said the Martha Stewart Show would end this summer. Turns out many viewers prefer reruns of Little House on the Prairie. Sally Herships has more.
You know what people like? Comfort food and comfort TV. Tom Umstead is programming editor at Multichannel News.
The Golden Girls, Little House on the Prairie, I Love Lucy.
Reruns like those are like the mashed potatoes and gravy of television. And they are what, Umstead says, the Hallmark Channel is known for. So the all-American, craftsy Martha Stewart Show was expected to do well there. But Hallmark says it will only air the show through the summer, which was a big surprise.
It's not like they're trying to fit Martha Stewart into MTV's block.
Martha Stewart's company says ratings for the show are up since last year, and it's won two Emmys. But Umstead says enough viewers are just not tuning in. Bob Thompson teaches TV and popular culture at Syracuse.
The problem with the Martha Stewart Show and the Martha Stewart brand is that it's gone out of style.
Tim Calkins teaches marketing at Kellogg School of Management. He says in an effort to keep growing, the brand has stretched itself too thin and lost its specialness.
They've done a heck of a lot of licensing deals.
You can buy Martha Stewart at Kmart or Sears.
And then there's the Martha Stewart collection at PetSmart, and there's the Martha Stewart collection at Home Depot and at Macy's and now at JCPenney.
Martha Stewart says the show that's ending is just one of a group of shows that airs on the Hallmark Channel. And what Tom Umstead says about Martha's brand sounds like something Pa Ingalls would say on Little House. You may be suffering now, but you're still strong at the core. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
It was the second up day of the year on Wall Street. We'll have details when we do the numbers. Has there been a bigger, more spectacular Broadway failure in recent memory than Spider-Man the Musical? Well, before you answer, hear this. It just broke a record for highest revenue from ticket sales in a single week. Yes, the $75 million butt of brutal and nightly jokes on Letterman, not to mention bad reviews and injuries to cast members, turned its spidey sense into box office gold. Our New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore spins the tale.
Spider-Man the Musical is a Broadway show. The tale of its survival could also be a Broadway show. After injuries, infighting, and reviewers' insults, the tide turns. In a triumphant twist, the show set a Broadway record for the most ticket sales in a single week, $2.9 million. Jerry Harris, the veteran theater financier who co-produced it, is still searching for the words.
Satisfied would not be the right word. We feel elated, or we feel maybe vindication is not right either, but we feel accomplishment.
In the story behind the musical, his antagonist would be Ben Brantley, the chief theater critic of the New York Times. Brantley once compared Spider-Man the Musical to watching the Hindenburg burn and crash.
I don't think there's been a case in which a play was as savagely reviewed as Spider-Man was, where it went on to this kind of spectacular success.
Brantley attributes that to tourists who are coming to New York in droves. Harris, the co-producer, calls it creating a new audience. He points out that as many men as women buy tickets, which is rare on Broadway. Still, Spider-Man would have to have about 5 years of record weeks to make up its costs. But the story of redemption may be priceless. In New York, I'm Heidi Moore for Marketplace.
Europeans are noting a not-so-happy anniversary this week. Amid all the tension over Eurozone debt and who should bail out whom, they're marking 10 years since the launch of the first Euro notes and coins. You may remember all the hoopla and hope over the new currency. Suffice it to say, the mood has since soured. But perhaps the Europeans should not have been so optimistic a decade ago. As Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports from London, currency unions like this one usually don't pay.
Currency unions are usually created for the best of reasons, economist Andrew Hilton.
Using the same currency is a convenience for everyone. If you're in New York and you have to have a different currency when you cross the bridge into New Jersey, that's an inconvenience.
He says there was much monetary inconvenience before the US launched its own nationwide currency in the 1860s. There were 10,000 different types of US banknote in circulation. The country was crying out for a common currency. Another advantage, you don't have the cost of exchanging one currency into another. That explains why currency unions between separate countries have also been popular, although not always long-lasting.
The vast majority of them fail.
Barry Bosworth of the Brookings Institution.
They have fallen apart when they have not been in the interest of all the members. The ones that fail, they fail when there's no longer a common benefit.
Take the Latin Monetary Union set up in 1865. France, Italy, Belgium, Switzerland, and others adopted the same monetary system. It was backed by gold and silver. It finally collapsed in 1926. Andrew Hilton.
In the Latin monetary union, well, the Italians cheated and they pulled it apart.
The Italians broke the rules by minting many more coins than they were allowed. Another common currency involved the Scandinavian monetary union. It was set up in 1872 by Sweden, Denmark and Norway. Barry Bosworth says that didn't last either.
Basically, they cheated on each other, particularly against the Swedish government.
The other countries in the Union were increasingly converting their cheap metal coins into Swedish gold, draining Sweden's reserves.
And Sweden finally decided it didn't want anything to do with it anymore.
Similar trickery and mistrust have more recently undermined the euro, with Greece lying about the size of its budget deficit and Germany reluctant to bail it out. So what have the Europeans to learn from history and from the success of America's currency union?
They have to learn that you can't have monetary union without some kind of political union.
Philip Booth of the Institute for Economic Affairs says currency unions are always more credible when the member states have a strong common purpose, such as nationhood.
Ensuring that investors are confident that the monetary union will never break up.
Since the banking crisis erupted 3 years ago, some investors have complained about the US Federal Reserve debasing the dollar by printing money. But no one seriously doubts that the dollar will survive. The same cannot be said today for the euro. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Coming up, the complicated task of fighting famine and crisis.
We and a lot of other agencies had grants running out that were not being renewed. Getting a definitive answer on what the cause for that was proved very difficult.
But first, let's do the numbers. Wall Street seesawed on its second trading day of the year. The Dow Jones Industrial Average recovered from an early dip to rise 21 points, about a tenth of a percent, closing at 12,418. The NASDAQ ended flat at 2,648. The S&P 500 also flat at 1,277. Eastman Kodak swooned 28% to an all-time low on rumors that it will file for bankruptcy protection. The New York Stock Exchange has warned the iconic photography company that it could be delisted because its share price is less than a dollar. One positive standout was TiVo. Shares of the Pioneer digital TV recorder rose 10%. Yesterday, AT&T agreed to pay TiVo more than $200 million to settle a patent infringement lawsuit. AT&T's shares picked up 0.1%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.98%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. Chain stores are scheduled to report December sales. Ho, ho, ho. Can I still say that? The curtain raises on the Palm Springs International Film Festival. It runs through the 16th. And the residents of Pine Valley stepped into the spotlight on January 5th, 1970 with the premiere of All My Children. We tracked their stories until last year when the soap went off the air. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. This week, we've been running a series of commentaries to mark the start of the new year, predicting the 2012 headlines that you might be talking about. But today, we're taking a step back to a story that dominated the news in 2011. Commentator Reza Aslan says the Arab Spring isn't finished quite yet.
2011 served as a reminder to us all that no regime can stand up to the will of a people united in the cause of freedom and democracy. In the span of a year, dictatorships in Tunisia, Egypt, and Libya fell, and significant political reform was forced upon the governments of Morocco, Jordan, and Oman. Now, as the Arab Spring enters a new year, with revolutions still smoldering in Syria, Bahrain, Yemen, and beyond, there's one question we should ask. Can religiously inspired parties that have come to political prominence in the aftermath of these popular uprisings transform themselves into responsible members of democratic governments? Pundits and politicians are already ringing the alarm bells. A common refrain in the U.S. is that the Middle East is being overrun with religious radicals bent on oppressing women and destroying Israel. That's nonsense, of course. Nevertheless, there is no doubt that political Islam will be a force in the new democratic Middle East. And that's a good thing. It's time for these religious parties to stop hiding in the mosque and instead be forced to compete openly in the marketplace of ideas for the votes of a free electorate. After all, what could be more important to a burgeoning democracy than an open debate about the role of religion in society? A few months ago, such talk would have landed you in prison. Today, it's part of the vibrant political debate that's taking place all over the Middle East. It remains to be seen whether the newly elected Islamist parties in Egypt and Tunisia will moderate their ideologies and focus on the immediate demands of the people who voted them into office. But this much is certain. If they do not, if they spend their time railing about the West instead of creating jobs for the people, they'll be booted out of office just as quickly as they were voted in. That's how democracies work. And whether we like it or not, for the first time in decades, neither the aging autocrats in the region nor their American backers have anything to say about it.
Reza Aslan is the author of No God But God. Got a comment? Go to marketplace.org and click on contact. This holiday season, you may have noticed an uptick in appeals for help with the famine in Somalia. More than 30,000 people have died. The UN says the worst may have passed, yet a quarter of a million Somalis still live on the edge of starvation. Marketplace's Scott Tong traveled to the region last fall and reports now on whether this was a preventable tragedy.
In the fall, I held a baby Somali boy at a refugee hospital in Kenya.
He was so thin, his legs were barely thicker than my microphone.
And how many pounds is he?
2.5 kilos, so less than 6 pounds at 2 months.
Inside Somalia, it's worse. University of Minnesota professor Abdi Samatar visited camps in Mogadishu, where the Somalis were fighting over food rations.
What was most troubling is the way people lose their dignity. You are this hungry hyena or hungry cheetah or what have you, and you have to behave in certain ways to get access to that food. That's so dehumanizing.
Somalia's famine is complicated. There's drought, lawlessness, war. It looks hopeless. Yet many experts believe this was preventable if the world had responded sooner, with aid and with money. The warnings were there.
January 2011 was already a massive crisis, particularly in southern Somalia.
Grania Maloney works for the UN Somalia Food Security Unit. Last winter, long before famine was declared, the rains had already failed. Food was scarce.
We then had 2.4 million people in crisis. The prices had doubled, and the outlook was not good.
Each day, upwards of 1,000 Somalis were fleeing for refugee camps. Yet somehow, hardly anyone showed up at relief aid meetings across Africa and the world. The Arab Spring stole the headlines. The White House said nothing. And aid from the U.S., the world's most generous country, was nosediving. From 2008 to 2010, U.S. aid to Somalia fell by 88%. Jeremy Kanindake works for Mercy Corps, which receives grants from the U.S. government.
We and a lot of other agencies had grants running out that were not being renewed. Getting a definitive answer on what the cause for that was proved very difficult.
As famine approached, aid was frozen, according to government emails and a diplomatic cable released by WikiLeaks. Washington feared that aid was being stolen or taxed by a Muslim extremist group new to the U.S. terror list, Al-Shabaab. Cameron Hudson was on the White House National Security Staff.
There were increasing indications the Shabaab was actively reaching out both to the Al-Qaeda in East Africa network and then also at the same time reaching back to Al-Qaeda core in Pakistan and Afghanistan.
At least one intelligence report questions those links. But Hudson says the dominant view then was of a lethal Shabaab kept in business by bribing and extorting aid groups.
You have to go after things like sources of revenue from which they derive power. That was a very active effort.
With teeth. U.S. officials can be prosecuted if aid gets to terrorists. But relief workers say in the fog of disaster, aid money leaks out in all directions. So the U.S. aid agency sought legal exemptions. But at White House meetings, counterterrorism officials pushed back.
And that constricted the ability for aid agencies to deliver the kind of assistance that they were wishing to deliver.
Also slowing the response, top officials were said to be slow to stick out their necks for Somalia. Bronwyn Bruton is with the Atlantic Council think tank.
Time after time, any intervention in Somalia has gone belly up. So there are very few policymakers, in fact, none that I can think of, who want to be responsible for the policy. It's like catching the hot potato.
U.S. aid officials deny any dithering.
I welcome this opportunity to correct what I think is a profound misconception.
Nancy Lindborg is with the U.S. Agency for International Development. If anyone has blood on their hands, she blames Al-Shabaab, which threatens and expels aid groups.
Only in the southern parts of Somalia, which are controlled by Shabaab and other groups where there was very limited humanitarian access, did it go from crisis to famine. That's the causal relationship.
Lindborg says aid fell off when a key U.S. partner, the World Food Program, pulled out of Somalia. WFP officials said it was too dangerous there, and Shabaab was demanding payments for security. But another WikiLeaks cable suggests the program was responding to U.S. terror laws. WFP withdrew, quote, to escape from U.S. legislation and not feel embarrassed. WFP is not commenting on the cable. Jeremy Kanindike at Mercy Corps notes that other aid groups have stayed on.
If you look at the numbers, you don't see the kind of decline amongst other donors that you see from the U.S. And that says to me that other donors were finding ways around the access obstacles, and the U.S. was not.
By the late spring of 2011, refugee flows had swelled to 1,500 a day. One in five Somali children was eating the equivalent of a plate of rice a day. By July, the UN declared famine, in its words, the most severe humanitarian crisis in the world. Only then did international contributions ramp up. Only then did Washington lift terrorism restrictions on aid. Robert Parlberg teaches food security at Wellesley College.
In Somalia today, our mission from the start really has been political. The humanitarian objective has never really been able to take first place. Well, that's too bad because of the magnitude of the famine that's underway.
U.S. officials are now pushing in food and money in creative ways. But again, the critics argue this was due last winter. For all the warnings, this reminds them of Somalia's famine 20 years ago, when 200,000 people died. A U.S. report says 70% of those lives could have been saved, but, quote, resources, political will, and effort were not available when needed. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
And we have photos and profiles from Scott's 7-part East Africa series at marketplace.org.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
And this final note, procrastinators rejoice. You have an extra 2 days to file your taxes this year. Today, the Internal Revenue Service announced it is extending the deadline from the usual April 15th to April 17th. A rare moment of generosity? No, not really. The 15th falls on a Sunday this year, and Monday the 16th is a holiday in the District of Columbia. So nobody will be there to collect your money anyway. And that is Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 21 points, 0.1%. The NASDAQ was flat, as was the S&P 500. Ravi Karman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bradford Craig, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, and Brendan Willard engineer the program for us. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. Next time on this show, the jobs picture is still bleak, but are we feeling more like the glass is half full?
We're seeing numbers creeping back up. Consumer confidence looks like it's starting to edge back up from where it was even a week or two ago.
It's the latest installment of Attitude Check, our partnership with Gallup. I'm Tess Vigeland. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.